U.S. economy, the doctor will see you now. Say cheese.
Right now, the most important task for us is to stabilize the patient. The economy is badly damaged. It is very sick.
Sick, perhaps, but the cure isn't taking office for weeks, and Congress expects to have no stimulus plans in time for the inauguration. Economy on life support. Washington only has a pill. Chill. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 6th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, everyone. Today, a new beginning for the Senate, the latest on the Mumbai attacks, the investigation, and the regulators on the hot seat in the alleged Madoff scam. Those stories are coming up first. These headlines.
Israeli ground troops are staged around heavily populated Gaza City, which means the fight against Hamas may take place house to house. Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman David Segel says the fight will go on until the rocket threat inside Israeli territory is gone.
Any country that wants sovereignty and wants freedom and wants normalcy cannot tolerate a situation in which an Iranian-inspired terror organization continues to fire rockets at Israel's civilian population.
Hamas spokesman Ghazi Hamad wants the attacks to be finished.
We need at this time a real solution that the siege is lifted and open over the crossings and stop the military operation against our people. But really what we need is stop this criminal targeting of Gaza.
The United Nations says more than 500 Palestinians are dead in Gaza. About a quarter are civilians. Illinois Senate appointee Roland Burris has a showdown plan. The Blagojevich pick now says he will go to Capitol Hill today and attempt to walk onto the Senate floor. It's not clear what will happen, but top Senate Democrats have said they will block him from being sworn in. Literally, we have no idea. The Senate opens at noon today.
The Minnesota Senate election results are now certified, but if you think that means we have a winner, well, think again. Here's Minnesota Chief Justice Eric Magnuson.
I don't think we've written the last chapter in this particular election. That many votes, this close. I don't think any system is designed to handle that without a few squeaks.
The certified count says Democrat Al Franken got a couple hundred more votes than Republican Norm Coleman, but Coleman has a week to challenge the results, and his lawyers say he plans to. He's scheduled to speak out later today. President-elect Obama has settled on his top spy masters. He chose Leon Panetta to lead the CIA. The former Clinton insider is a surprise pick since he has no direct intelligence experience. Retired Admiral Dennis Blair is being tapped for Director of National Intelligence.
A 1% drop in the Dow yesterday. It begins trading at 89.52. The S&P lost nearly 0.5%, finishing at 9.27. It's happy birthday this morning to Spirit and Opportunity up there on Mars. 5 years they've been going. The engineers who built them for NASA expected them only to go for 3 months. They turned five this month. They're still going. They got some problems. One has a flat tire. There's some solar panels that need to be dusted off. But above and beyond the call of duty, Spirit and Opportunity have certainly served that. We're talking about what above and beyond stories you have in your life. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. What did you buy that, like, drove forever? Volvos, Hondas. We actually heard a story from a Honda owner. Anything more that gave you more than you ever imagined? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The situation is getting worse. We've got to act boldly, and we've got to act swiftly. We cannot delay.
Today, the Senate formally convenes after President-elect Barack Obama made the rounds yesterday about his top priority, the economy. But first, the Senate has to figure out who's getting seated.
There comes a time when you have to acknowledge that the race is over. The race in Minnesota is over. Now it's only a little finger pointing.
The race in Minnesota is not over. Under Minnesota law, an election certificate does not issue until litigation has been concluded.
That's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Republican Minority Leader Senator Mitch McConnell. On the line now is Todd Zwillick, reporter for Capital News Connection. He's coming to us from Washington. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning. I got my Mars birthday lapel pin on today. I love it.
All right, Todd.
That's good. Thank you for sharing, Todd. We do appreciate that. But is all of these questions about who is going to get a seat in the Senate, is that distracting? Will that be distracting as President-elect Obama tries to push ahead with the stimulus package?
Well, it'll be distracting this week. I don't think there's any question about that. It gets in the way of some of the pomp and circumstance of swearing in day and some of the momentum of the first week. But the dream of getting the stimulus done by January 20th, by Inauguration Day, so that Obama can sign it as his first act in office, that's not going to happen anyway. So I think the distraction for the larger stimulus is probably not too great, because the Illinois seat and the Minnesota seat and also the replacement for Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, those will probably be settled by the time they get down to the meat of the stimulus, certainly by the time they vote on it, I would expect.
Tell us about President-elect Obama's rounds yesterday, and what was the reaction of some of the lawmakers?
Well, it was a lot of shuttle diplomacy yesterday. The president-elect was into one meeting with Harry Reid, and then out, and then House leaders, Democrats, came over, and then out of that one, then bipartisan meeting, and then over to bipartisan House, Senate, 12 people in the room. So it was a lot of walking back and forth past crowded pools of reporters with camera shutters flying and Klieg lights blaring in the hallway of the Senate where they were walking back and forth. He stopped and talked to some kids. His mood was bright. You know, Barack Obama, we all know already that he's a master of managing the moment and a master of setting the right mood for the time. So he looked upbeat. Now, your question coming out of those meetings, and the real issue is Republicans, isn't it, and how they're going to react to this huge stimulus that's coming down the pipe here, $800 billion, $900 billion. No one knows quite how big it's going to be. And any spending package that big tends to make Republicans cringe. So they were encouraged, however, by this plan leaked, announced the other day, that 40% of that package will be tax breaks. And if you want to know how that's a stimulus, well, one thing that it stimulates is Republican support.
And
Republicans, yeah.
And were there particular details of that $800 billion? You're saying 40% would break down for some kind of tax breaks. Who do the tax breaks go to, and what is the other 60% made up of?
Well, the brushstrokes are pretty broad right now, Adora. So when they say tax breaks, they say middle class and businesses. There are some sketches that are coming out. This bill is not written, but there are ideas being floated. Business tax breaks for businesses that create or preserve jobs.
Although Obama was saying that these are his middle class tax cuts. This was what he campaigned on. He actually described the convergence between what he called for in the campaign and what he says are the tax cuts needed right now. That would argue for middle class.
Correct. And do you remember the controversy in the campaign? What qualifies as middle class? If you make $190,000 a year, are you middle class? That's yet to be defined. Who's going to be middle class to qualify for their tax break? That's not decided yet. And those things, you know, Republicans love to hear about tax breaks, but I guarantee you there will be a fight over who qualifies as middle class when this finally gets down to negotiations.
So this draft is going to develop over the weeks, and particularly we would expect it to pick up as soon as Barack Obama is inaugurated. But in terms of the Senate, let's talk about who has been appointed to fill his vacant Senate seat, Roland Burris. He is in Washington, D.C., I understand.
Yes, he is, and he says he's going to be showing up on Capitol Hill today. And that's raised the specter, of course, of some kind of confrontation, some kind of camera-ready moment of an appointee, a senator to be, an African-American senator to be, by the way, trying to get into the front door of the Capitol and being barred somehow. It looks
sounds
like
more like
everybody
a shovel-ready moment that they're talking about in the Senate. They want him out of there.
Well, the Senate Democrats certainly do. I think the Senate Republicans are rather enjoying this whole thing. I mean, why not? It certainly takes some of the momentum away from the Democrats' senatorial inaugural victory moment of having gained so many seats and getting close to that 60 number. So Burris is planning to show up today. It looks like both sides are trying to avoid that shovel-ready, camera-ready confrontation moment. Dick Durbin, the senior senator from Illinois, threw out a little olive branch yesterday to some reporters and offered to have Burris join him in his office if he'd like to watch on TV. But you're not getting
you
on the floor,
just come
buddy.
Into this room and put yourself aside.
Yes, and be quiet. Well, you're not a senator. You're not going to be getting on the floor until we decide that you're a senator. So we'll see how that plays out. There is a meeting scheduled, as you mentioned earlier. Burris is scheduled to meet with Durbin and Reid on Wednesday, and maybe they'll sort something out.
Okay. Todd Zwillick, thank you.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick is a reporter for Capital News Connection, and he was reporting to us from Washington.
Blue Oyster Cult here on The Takeaway, and blue is the term best used to describe the final numbers for 2008. The car sales numbers are absolutely abysmal, especially for Chrysler Corporation, who saw its sales of new cars drop by more than 50%. Joining us now is John Wolkonowicz, a senior analyst with IHS Global Insight. He's speaking to us from Lexington, Massachusetts. John, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you this morning.
You know, these are, it's strange to be saying this in the same sentence. They're not unexpected, and they're utterly draconian. I guess the question really going forward is how much of this is a blip related to, say, the credit crunch causing a temporary squeeze in the auto market, and how much of this is a permanent sort of restructuring of the entire auto business?
Well, I don't think this is about a permanent restructuring of the entire auto business. We will get back to the 17 million years that we saw just a few years ago. There's no reason that's not going to happen. So this is a rather severe cyclical downturn, and it really is caused by the economic conditions that we're all facing here in this country and on a global level as well.
How much of the product line is driving this? Of course, when we were making all of the records in the last decade, the profits were driven by heavy trucks, SUVs. Now it seems like the product demands, particularly on the domestic side, have radically transformed. Do those products, these new products, hybrids and others, get us back to the 17 million vehicle level?
What's going to happen also is that come 2011, we're going to be working under much more stringent CAFE rules for mandated fuel economy. So, you know, even if gas prices were to stay very low, which, by the way, we're not forecasting, the mix of vehicles will shift. And yes, auto companies are going to have to learn how to make more money, more profitability off of smaller vehicles. And, you know, the answer to how that's going to happen is really pretty simple. Smaller vehicles are going to cost more in the future.
And the expectation is, again, to your $17 million expectation, the expectation is that people will be getting rid of the SUVs and going for smaller cars, and that's going to ultimately drive demand once the economy improves.
Well, I don't think that's what's going to drive demand. I think it's really going to be simply that people will need new vehicles. The average age of the vehicle fleet is going up and is reaching levels now because of the very slow sales year we had this year and what is going to follow for the next couple of years. People are just going to need to replace vehicles because the average age of the fleet is rising to almost unprecedented levels.
Well, a silver lining. Quickly, the domestic sales are bad enough, but the foreign sales were also pretty bad. Can you run down Toyota and Honda for us?
Well, Toyota and Honda were both down about 36%, which was the market average. The interesting part was that was a larger decline than what we saw from GM and Ford. Ford down 32 year over year in December and GM down 31. What this indicates, when companies like Toyota and Honda are having those kinds of double-digit declines year over year, the market is extremely weak.
Right, it's weak, and the question is, are we finding a bottom here? And, you know, some of the numbers suggest maybe that's the case. John Wolkonowicz, thanks so much for joining us. He's a senior analyst with IHS Global Insight. He spoke with us from Lexington, Massachusetts, about the auto sales, final auto sales for 2008, down, way down.
We'll be right back. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. You know, forget Energizer bunnies. The Mars rovers take the cake now. They were expected to go for 3 months. They're 5 years old today, up there on Mars and still running. Got us wondering what else went longer than you thought, served above and beyond the call of duty, gave you more than you ever imagined. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The sole surviving gunman from the brutal attacks in Mumbai last month is now awaiting trial in India. Yesterday, India's prime minister turned over some of the state's investigation of the attacks to Pakistan. He described the evidence as showing that the attack was so sophisticated that the attackers must have had help from official Pakistani agencies. Nazes Afros, the BBC South Asia editor, is following the story, and he joined us earlier from London. And I asked him if he had any sense at all about what kind of evidence was provided to Pakistan.
The evidence, we do not know. The Indian authorities, they have handed over. It's a dossier, we understand. It's a dossier which they have put together for the last 5-6 weeks after the arrest of the sole surviving gunman and further investigation. And they have handed over to the Pakistani authorities. They have not been made public. But yesterday, Indian foreign minister also met with quite a few diplomats, which they call friendly countries, diplomats from friendly countries, ambassadors and high commissioners from around the world, at least 25 of them we understand, and also shared the same information with them, but it has not been made public yet.
Some of the reporting has suggested that the evidence includes details from interrogations, from information from some of the recovered weapons and intercepted communications. How did Pakistan respond?
Well, Pakistan only responded today officially. Yesterday, it was handed over to Pakistan. And after that, we saw in the Pakistani newspapers this morning, they were quoting officials, unnamed officials, saying that they were rubbishing the dossier largely. They were saying that it is inadequate. It is not concrete proof. And today in Pakistani parliament, the junior foreign minister of Pakistan, he also said the same thing, repeated the same thing. So the official line of Pakistan is going to be, this is inadequate, this is not enough, this is not concrete proof, we want more evidence. And so I think it is just that kind of blame game that will that has been going on for the past 5-6 weeks ever since the attacks happened in Mumbai. So the Indians, almost every day on a day-to-day basis, they are creating headlines by blaming Pakistan every day, and they're raising the game. So today, when the Indian prime minister, actually when he had a meeting with all the chief ministers, the chief ministers of all Indian states, in which he mentioned that the sophistication and all other evidences that we gathered, it is quite likely that this gunman, the attackers, had support from official Pakistani agencies.
And in addition to that, yesterday the foreign minister then made a request of India, and let's listen to that request.
As far as the government of Pakistan is concerned, we ask only that it implement the bilateral commitments that it has made at the highest levels to India and practices her international obligations.
So what did he mean by implement the bilateral commitments, and what is India seeking, and is whatever India is seeking going to be enough to satisfy what many Indians are going to feel need to be done by Pakistan?
Well, I don't think there is any sort of official bilateral agreement. It is the understanding. You know, there is this South Asian Cooperation Group, which is called SARC, South Asia Regional Cooperation. They have their annual summit, and they also have their ministerial level meetings. So there is some consensus in the SARC meetings, and also bilaterally with all the South Asian countries, that fighting terrorism or fighting extremism is one of their main agendas. So this is something he's referring to. This is what he's saying, that this is Pakistan's commitment to fight terrorism, and they should deliver that, they should implement it. And India in the past had always accused Pakistan of sponsoring. If you go back 7-8 years, then we at that point we see all the statements coming out of Indian officials, ministers. They had been even saying that it was state-sponsored terrorism. After that, they have had quite a few meetings. There was confidence-building measures. The peace process was in place for the last 4 years, and they were coming to some understanding that they would share information. You remember there was another attack in Mumbai in 2006. After that, it was decided that the two countries, they would sit together, they would share information, and they would try to help each other to root out extremism and root out terrorism. This is what he has been referring to.
And so at this point, how would you describe the tensions between the two countries that seem to have ebbed and flowed since the Mumbai attacks?
It is, I think, at a very, very critical stage. If you look at the statement by the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh today, it is very significant in my opinion, because Indian Prime Minister is a very measured man. He has not really raised the bar so high in the last few weeks. It was other ministers, the foreign minister and the home minister, they had been giving statements to the media, local media, as well as international media. And they were gradually stepping up the pressure on Pakistan. They would like to see some kind of action from Pakistan. They would like to see that Pakistan actually has arrested some people and are ready to hand over some of the people. Of course, Pakistan is not going to do that. They are not going to hand over anyone to India. I mean, the Pakistani domestic political compulsion mm-hmm. will not let the Pakistani politicians to do that. So they want something to happen. We must also remember that India is going to face a general election. Indian parliamentary
right.
elections are due in April. So this is also, to some extent, for domestic consumption. The Indian government, the Congress-led coalition government, which is going to face the electorate in 3-4 months' time, they also would like to show to its electorate that they are not weak. They are not weak in fighting terrorism.
Nazes Afros, the BBC South Asia editor, thank you. And now we turn to Femi, who's got the headlines of the hour.
And the time is 28 minutes past the hour. President-elect Barack Obama's proposed stimulus package has a sweet spot for businesses. They could receive billions of dollars in a refund of taxes they paid several years ago. That could increase pressure on Republicans to support the package, which may have a price tag of $800 billion. The top UN official in Gaza says that nowhere is safe. John Ging is blaming the international community for the rising death toll of the Israeli military campaign. He says political leaders need, and I'm going to quote him here, to get their act together and stop this. The European Union says it's completely unacceptable that several European countries have been cut off from gas supplies. The gas usually flows through Ukraine pipes, but Russia cut the country off after a bill dispute, and the EU is demanding that the supply be restored immediately. And President Bush is making the largest marine conservation effort in history. He's designated nearly 200,000 square miles in the Pacific Ocean as National Marine Monuments. Has a look at some stories making the news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So you bought that car. You laid down the money. How long did you figure it would last? Huh? How many miles would you get out of that car? How many weekends would you get out of that tool that you bought? Or you know, anything that you purchased and assumed would last maybe the lifetime of the warranty? Anything really work out for you?
I purchased a Play School flashlight for my toddler daughter about 10 years ago, and it still works as well as the day that we bought it. In my household, I kept flashlights for emergencies, and the batteries are always running out or the bulbs would dim. And it seems that when we have an emergency in our household and the lights do go out, we look for the Play School flashlight, and it's always worked for us.
Play School flashlights, not just for toddlers anymore. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, June 10th, 2003, the launch of a rocket was just the beginning.
3, 2, 1, engine start, and liftoff of the Delta II rocket carrying the Spirit from Earth to planet Mars.
Well, there was plenty of Spirit left on planet Earth. The little Mars rovers that were launched that day became a cultural phenomenon all over the world. The Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, are 5 years old today. Joining us to celebrate truly a scientific, engineering, and cultural milestone is Raymond Arvison, Deputy Principal Investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover Mission and a professor at Washington University in St. Louis, but we found him in Volcano, Hawaii. Raymond, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
I mean, first, congratulations, buddy.
Oh, thanks.
I mean,
you know, no one ever expected these rovers to continue for 5 years. We sent two because we thought one would work, and we would have been happy for 3 months. So they're just well-made vehicles.
And, you know, part of the story of them working longer than 3 months is a discovery of how Mars actually works. Tell the story of the dust on the solar panels and how Mars managed to clean it off for you.
Well, the Spirit rover in particular landed at a dusty site, and every 3 months to 6 months, there's an amazing amount of dust that forms on the panels. Today, for example, the latest data indicates that 3/4 of the sunlight is reflected back because there's so much dust on the panels. So we're waiting for a wind event, probably a dust devil. And this has happened several times in the past. So, you know, the dust comes, the dust goes, but we need to kind of wish together for a wind event to clean off the solar panels so we can get more power on Spirit right now.
Well, you say wind event, but basically you guys get up in the morning, look at the weather report on Mars, and try to figure out if you're going to get enough sun to operate the batteries, right?
That's right. And we actually look down at the deck with the cameras and look at the dust, and then we measure the amount of power coming off the panels. So we have enough to survive, but we'd sure like more. And we're hoping what's happening now with the Spirit rover is we're parked facing the sun, tilted toward the sun, and Christmas Day, in fact, was the start of the spring season. So the sun is getting higher, and that's when all the dust devils and the high winds occur. So we're hoping for a wind gust, to clear some of the dust off sooner rather than later.
Well, Spirit and Opportunity began a whole series of discoveries about the red planet that I'm sure you could speak for many, many hours about. But it also seems to me that emotionally, every one of you scientists has a foot on Mars as a result of these very unique tools, robots, joystick-operated trucks. Is that how you feel?
That's exactly right. And it goes all the way back to the day of landing back in 2004. With Spirit and then with Opportunity, because you know, when we landed and the first pictures came back, at least for me, it was kind of a spine-tingling event because the terrain looks eerily Earth-like. You know, this is another planet. It's a place that's different than Earth in terms of its evolution, but also similar processes have taken place. So, you know, as soon as the first pictures came back, said, oh, you know, this is not a totally alien landscape. This is like one of the hyper-arid deserts of Earth. And this has continued because the rovers drive, as you know, and we see new landscapes and make new discoveries. So even after 5 years, it's kind of fun to go to work and see what's come in from the last night's observations.
One of the other surprises, maybe not, but it seems from my perspective it was sort of a surprise, was just how much the world was involved through the website and just following Spirit and Opportunity, these little robots.
I think what's happened is that since we're explorers, adventurers, if you will, and we're driving, there are new landscapes, you know, every few days or thereabouts. And people have adopted these rovers kind of like cousins traveling on another continent and emailing back their photos from the day. So there's an amazing following, which is great, you know, because the public is paying for this. So I think they're getting their money's worth.
Well, they don't necessarily feel like it's a transaction. Listen to the words of Sophie Collis, who's a 9-year-old who actually ended up naming Spirit an opportunity.
Right.
This is him speaking back in 2003.
I used to live in the orphanage. It was dark and cold and lonely. At night, I looked up at the sparkly sky. I felt better. I dreamed I could fly there. In America, I can make all my dreams come true. Thank you for the spirit and the opportunity.
That 9-year-old named the rovers, and now he's a 15-year-old, Raymond. You know,
I remember that. That's a beautiful set of words.
And were you surprised at how much of sort of America's spirit is actually up there with those robots?
I am, but I'm really happy about it because it's really nice, you know, because there's science being done, or we're demonstrating some advanced technology and engineering, and then the public is basically adopted. They have a sense of ownership of these rovers.
Well, I certainly do, and I want to thank you and all of your pals at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in NASA for being a part of the takeaway today. The rovers are turning 5. Raymond Arvidson, Deputy Principal Investigator of Mars Exploration Rover Mission and a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. To Femi Okay with a headline.
Good morning. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Some lawmakers say they may oppose President-elect Barack Obama's appointment for CIA director. He's chosen Liam Panetta, a former congressman and White House chief of staff. Incoming Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein says that she believes the agency is best served by an intelligence professional. The president-elect's choice to be Director of National Intelligence was more expected. It will be retired Admiral Dennis Blair. Car sales for Ford and GM were down a third last month. Chrysler's domestic sales fell by a half. Toyota is suspending production for almost 2 weeks, and Honda sales are down around about a third. Now, to counter customers' reluctance to buy new cars, Hyundai is trying to make customers feel comfortable about splurging.
Right now, buy any new Hyundai, and if in the next year you lose your income, we'll let you return it. That's the Hyundai Assurance. An automaker that's got your back. Isn't that a nice change?
So here's the deal. It means that if you fall on hard times and you have a leased or financed vehicle, you'll get a partial refund of your money. If you lose your job, you get sick, so go out and buy a car. Interesting times.
Sign of the times, as Prince would say.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Palestinians say Israeli attacks inside Gaza this morning have been intense. At least 18 people have been killed so far. Only 2 reportedly have been confirmed as militants. Last night, 3 Israeli soldiers were killed by what Israeli officials say was an errant tank round. For the latest, we spoke with Mike Sargent, who is covering the story for our partner, the BBC World Service. And we asked him if he could confirm reports that Israeli forces are widening their ground assault in the Gaza Strip.
Yes, that's right. It seems to have been escalating through the night and into the morning. Certainly BBC teams on the Israeli-Gaza border have heard pretty regular explosions, machine gun fire right along the length of Gaza. There seems still to be quite a bit of fighting in and around Gaza City in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, and also reports of Israeli tanks moving around Khan Yunis further to the south. And Deir al-Bala in the center of Gaza has also been pounded by Israeli naval ships, and reports that 10 Palestinians were killed there. So fighting continuing, intensifying, casualties mounting on both sides.
And are there more reports of Hamas missiles?
Yes, Hamas continues to fire at Israel. Now, Israel says it has dented the ability of Hamas to fire rockets at Israeli towns. There have been fewer of those in the last couple of days, but they are still continuing to fall. There have been a couple of rockets fired near our BBC Live position on the Israel-Gaza border, and that's been reported by our team down there. And so that goes on. So Israel wants to stop these rockets being fired, but as yet has not completely managed to do that.
And for many days we've been hearing about the humanitarian situation in Gaza. Aid agencies say that it's a fragile situation and it's deteriorated dramatically since the ground offensive began. What are the NGOs saying?
Well, they're saying it's a critical emergency now in Gaza, and it's getting worse by the day. Gaza's 1.5 million people. The United Nations says about a million of those are without electricity. Many people are without water. Food is running low. The medicines are desperately short the hospitals are desperately short of medicines. So it's a bad situation. Now, Israel has been letting some lorries cross from the Israeli side over into Gaza in recent days, but none have gone over today, is my understanding. And just to give you an example of the situation, they're not being delivered today on the Gaza side because one of the main contractors, his family, was caught up in an Israeli airstrike, and his son was killed. So they've said they can't work today. It's just one example of how the fighting impacts the humanitarian situation as well.
And as there are a few rockets, we have a few seconds left, as there are a few rockets flowing from Hamas, are you getting a sense that perhaps it's coming to an end, the Israeli offensive?
Well, slowly coming to an end, but it may intensify as diplomacy intensifies as well. Israel wants some guarantees, not only that Hamas has been diminished as a military force, but that it won't be able to resupply its rockets, and that's what the diplomats are working frantically on at the moment.
Mike Sargent is a reporter for the BBC World Service, and he was reporting to us from Jerusalem.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 6th, and Femi Oke has joined us with the morning's headlines.
Hello there. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. The top United Nations official in Gaza says that there's nowhere safe. He was speaking at Gaza's largest hospital. John Ging blames the international community for the rising death toll from the Israeli military campaign. He says that political leaders need to get their act together and stop this. Meanwhile, just an hour or so ago, we spoke to the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times, Ethan Bronner. He was talking about the frustration of just a few journalists trying to get into the Gaza Strip to report.
All we're asking is that the Israelis stamp our passports and let us through the international border between them and Gaza. And actually, it's not we who are asking. It is the Supreme Court of the country that is demanding it of the government.
Now, some humanitarian aid is able to get through. So, for instance, the International Red Cross says that conditions in Gaza were harsh even before the Israeli air and ground assault, and now that there's a full-blown humanitarian crisis. He's not a senator yet, but Blagojevich appointee Roland Burris promises to be at the Senate opening this afternoon anyway. He says that he will attempt to be sworn in. We'll have to see what actually happens. And Burris has told Senate security of his plans, and Senate Democratic leaders say he won't be given the oath of office. Minnesota also has a vacant Senate seat, long on drama. The election results are now certified, but there's no winner yet. The official count says that Democrat Al Franken got a couple of hundred more votes than Republican Norm Coleman, but Coleman has a week to challenge the results, and his lawyers say he plans to. He's scheduled to speak later today. That's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you very much, Femi. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Mars rovers. They're turning 5 years old today, and that's way older than anyone ever expected. The folks at NASA thought perhaps 3 months they'd last, but no, 5 years later, they're still here. And so we're asking today, what has lasted longer than you would have ever imagined in your wildest dreams? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
So it's expected that Bernard Madoff will stand trial for allegedly setting up the largest Ponzi scheme in history. He had a bail hearing, was in court yesterday. But there may be an even harsher verdict delivered against the regulatory agencies responsible for securities and bonds in the United States, particularly the main regulator, the Securities and Exchange Commission. Yesterday, the House Financial Services Committee met to determine whether regulators might have caught Madoff long before he allegedly bilked investors out of billions of dollars. One of the people testifying before that committee was Stephen Harbeck, president and CEO of the Security Investor Protection Corporation, the SIPC. Stephen Harbeck, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
First of all, what was the tone of the hearing yesterday? Are they looking to get to the bottom of the Madoff scam or much more focused on the Securities and Exchange Commission and principally SEC Chairman Christopher Cox?
Well, I think there was a bit of both. Certainly everyone wants to get to the bottom of what happened in the Madoff matter. But to do that, you have to decide how this Ponzi scheme went on for decades without it being discovered.
What was it about the economy that permitted the, as you describe in your testimony, the theft, the unprecedented theft of investor assets to go unnoticed and in a sense to be covered by a kind of paper profitability that concealed everything?
Well, the thing that is remarkable about this is that in a lot of Ponzi schemes, the perpetrator of the scheme produces extraordinary results for his investors. They're fictitious, of course, but they're higher above average results, a home run hitter, if you will. Madoff was a singles and doubles hitter. He never gave you a spectacular return, but you never lost any money ever, even in the downturn of the 2000 or anything else.
And so that's how he stayed under the radar, but not to everybody. There were some extraordinary revelations that are going to even be in more detail at these hearings this week on Capitol Hill, of people who actually did go to the SEC or go to the federal government or attempt to blow the whistle on Bernard Madoff. How much information did they have, and why was it ignored?
Well, that's what the Inspector General of the SEC was testifying about yesterday. They will examine why they didn't catch it and why, in the face of what appears to be a fairly detailed critique of his work, why the SEC didn't act in either 1999 or 2005.
17-page memo. That's pretty detailed. Is it that they're overwhelmed? Is it a resource question? Or is it that Madoff was just, just too prestigious, had a reputation that just was squeaky clean?
Oh, I think the latter certainly had something to do with this. People work on reputation in all aspects of life. This was, in many ways, an affinity fraud because so many of Madoff's victims were Jewish. He was a respected man in the Jewish community, and no one thought that it was even conceivable that he could do such a thing.
So his solidarity and his reputation were his biggest assets and were the biggest sort of enemy of the investors who lost.
That's true. This is a perfect example of trust but verify, but had you verified his record, it still would have come out as squeaky clean.
Now, some people were saying yesterday that Madoff's problem or the difficulty and the vulnerability for the investors was that unlike some other Ponzi schemes where investment transactions were actually cleared through reputable houses like Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers when it used to exist, Madoff was able to clear his own transactions just by going upstairs to his legit investment company. How much of a mix is there between these two?
Well, the two entities were actually one legal entity. In fact, Madoff's business model was something that's really kind of a throwback in many ways when each brokerage firm handled its own back office transactions. And stoop-shouldered men with suitcases would wander around Wall Street at the end of the business day exchanging physical stock certificates. The business model has moved to a situation where the larger firms clear for the overwhelming majority of firms of Madoff size.
So it was really invisible how the mix occurred, and in many ways that's part of the prosecution that's going to be taking place now.
That's right.
All right. Finally, you know, you're in a position to tell this story, and I don't know if you can or not, but part of the reason why I was dying to talk to you this morning is, you know, there's a moment in all of these schemes, and whether we're talking Enron, and it wasn't particularly a Ponzi scheme, but you know what I'm talking about, where redemptions, there's a kind of a run on the institution. Suddenly the jig is up. You look at the math and you see that it's not going to play out. It's not going to work. You had your chance to get out and you missed it. Whatever it's called, I don't know whatever you guys would refer to it. What do you think that moment was in this Madoff scandal?
That moment didn't happen.
Wow.
There was no point where the investors said, you know, this is sliding over the edge. This was a complete sudden going from 60 miles an hour to a dead stop. None of the investors, or at least any that did know, have not come to our attention. All of the investors were taken by this stunning confession that he made, rather than by the fact that you know, some of the usual keys, incorrect statements, failure to be able to get in touch with people, those kind of things that happen when a Ponzi scheme is collapsing, weren't present here.
When do you think Bernie Madoff and his sons knew that they weren't going to be able to conceal this anymore?
From the reports I heard, the result for Bernie Madoff was when, as a result of the economy, people actually wanted cash, and he simply couldn't come up with it.
And ultimately, he was down to about $300 million when it became clear that he had to disclose something here.
That's correct.
Wow. I mean, imagine having only $300 million in the bank and knowing the jig is up. It's a different world than for people like you and me, huh, Stephen?
Well, you know, the sums here are staggering. He claims he misappropriated $50 billion, but that included a lot of the phony profits that he was telling people that they had made, when in fact those transactions simply never took place.
Fiction writer. Thank you for joining us, Stephen. Stephen Harbeck, president and CEO of SIPC, Security Investor Protection Corporation. He testified on Capitol Hill before the House Financial Services Committee on the Bernard Madoff scandal.
Today, we've also been marking the fifth anniversary of the Mars rovers and asking you, when did you get more than you imagined? When did something last longer than you would have ever thought?
Just this last weekend, I initiated a coat and winter wear drive in my city, and I spoke of it in my home church, and a young man named Robert actually gave me the very coat off his back for the first coat of the drive, and it was a brutally cold, snowy day with temperatures well below zero, and this is a young man of very limited means. I thought that was inspirational.
My Medela brand breast pump, which was only supposed to last about 5 years, kept on helping me pump out breast milk for my babies for 10 years. Survived even a house fire in which it sat in a closet in a pool of water for several hours. And I picked it up afterwards and I kept on pumping.
Send it to Mars. That's great.
What's your tale of something that survived longer than you would have ever guessed? 877-8 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. And here's a thought for your takeaway today on the auto industry.
Auto companies are going to have to learn how to make more money, more profitability off of smaller vehicles. And, you know, the answer to how that's going to happen is really pretty simple. Smaller vehicles are going to cost more in the future.
That's a reporter from the New York Times. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Clarity. From Washington?
It's clear that we have to act, and we have to act now.
Another thing is clear. Congress is not agreeing to fast-track an economic stimulus package. Need a few more details, like the inauguration. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 6th, and that inauguration is exactly 2 weeks away.
and it's going to turn on the spigot for the economic stimulus package Obama hopes. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, everyone. An appointed but not welcome appointee to the Senate. We're going to explain that. President-elect Obama's choice as CIA spy master and Russia's gas. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
It's hard to know where to turn for guidance on the conflict in Gaza. President-elect Obama says, don't ask him.
It is particularly important to adhere to the principle of one president at a time, because there are delicate negotiations taking place right now, and we can't have two voices coming out of the United States when you have so much at stake.
Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki doesn't like the president-elect deferring to President Bush.
Disappointedly, that President-elect Obama refused to comment on the situation in Gaza, despite the fact that he commented on the situation on the bombing in Mumbai.
House-to-house combat may be the next phase of the fight between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Israeli ground troops are massed outside heavily populated Gaza City. 500,000 people live there. Political theater is on the Senate playbill for today. Again, Illinois Senate appointee Roland Burris has a showdown script written. The Blagojevich pick says he'll go to Capitol Hill and attempt to walk onto the Senate floor. He's told Senate security of his plans. Democratic leaders say they'll block him from being sworn in. Literally? We have no idea. The Senate opens at noon today. More on Burris in just a moment.
And more drama when it comes to the Minnesota Senate race. State election officials have certified the results, giving Democrat Al Franken a slim lead over Republican Norm Coleman. Top Senate Democrat Harry Reid says it's all over.
There comes a time when you have to acknowledge that the race is over. The race in Minnesota is over.
But it isn't, actually, because Coleman has a week to challenge the results, and his lawyer says he will. Two big hires for Team Obama. The president-elect picked Leon Panetta to lead the CIA. The former Clinton insider is something of a surprise pick, since he has no direct intelligence experience. Retired Admiral Dennis Blair is being tapped for Director of National Intelligence.
Wall Street kicks off in about a half an hour. The Dow dropped about 1% yesterday. It closed at 89.52. The S&P lost about a half percent, and it begins trading today at 9.27. Well, if you're a Mars rover, you're pretty proud of your brother and sister Spirit and Opportunity. They were only expected to go for 3 months, but for 5 years they've been ticking and moving and sending data back to NASA, which got us wondering, what went longer than you thought? When did you get more than you imagined?
I had a Sony Dream Machine alarm clock that I bought in 1983 to go to college. I smack that snooze button like the family dog every morning, and this thing just won't quit. It's absolutely amazing.
Have I told you about my Commodore 64? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Above and beyond the call of duty, your stuff.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. The 111th Congress begins its work today at noon, and there are big questions in the Senate, especially with the man who hopes to be the junior senator from Illinois.
I'm certainly not looking for drama. They're calling the drama. My appointment is legal. There's nothing that says that there's something wrong with Roland Burris. Are you saying that there's something wrong with me?
That's Burris, Roland Burris, this morning on CBS's Early Show. The would-be or could-be senator makes his D.C. debut today. It will be an uphill battle, though, as Senate leaders are arguing that Burris's appointment is tainted. Clarence Page is a syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and he joins us from Washington. Welcome back, Clarence.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
It almost sounds rhetorical when Burris says, I'm not going to make a scene. His mere presence on the Capitol, on Capitol Hill, is going to cause some hoopla.
Well, you know, you are so right, and you're taking my job as a commentator out of my hands, because that's, that's exactly what I was thinking when he said that. Very presence of Burris on Capitol Hill leads to all kinds of speculation. It draws reporters like flies to honey, and cameras, wondering if there will be a scene of Harry Reid, the Senate leader, and more correctly Terry Gaynor, the sergeant at arms, there standing in the doorway like George Wallace at the University of Alabama, keeping black students out. This kind of drama is something that we've been waiting to see. But Reid says he is open to negotiation. He said that under questioning on Meet the Press, which tells me that the winds of public opinion may actually be shifting in Burris's favor, if not Governor Blagojevich.
What do you think Senate Majority Leader, the Democratic Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, meant when he said that, that there was some room for negotiation? What's your sense?
Well, he's talking about some kind of a negotiated settlement which would allow Burris to be seated but maybe have limited powers, or some kind of a promise that he would not run again for the office after 2 years. That's a very popular piece of speculation. I find it to be quite dubious, having known Burris as a reporter and him as a newsmaker for about 30 years now. He's 71 years old. I think as long as he's kicking, he'd love to keep that job, frankly.
Well, can you just tell us a little bit, Clarence, about Roland Burris? We've heard his name, we've seen his name, but outside of Illinois, most people don't know a whole lot about him.
No, he was a pioneer, you could say, as the first black official to be elected statewide in Illinois back in the 70s as a state controller, which is really the state's accountant, you could say. And he also was later elected attorney general. And he's a former banking executive, a lawyer, of course, and someone who was very affable, friendly, a Barack Obama of his day, you could say, actually, in the state. But not with nearly those good political instincts. He's run for, I believe, governor three times, senator once, mayor of Chicago once. And never did he get past the primaries.
Well, in fact, he had a relationship with Harold Washington, the mayor of Chicago, who was a political master. And
yes.
I think the sort of African-American power elite in the Chicago area of Illinois always viewed Burris as kind of a lightweight, and it would seem that this is his only shot.
That's right. He'd been out of politics, actually, for several years. It was these unusual circumstances here of Rod Blagojevich's endorsement being political poison that caused everybody else to shrink back and Burris to jump up and say, well, I'm ready to be asked. And Blagojevich was more than happy to ask him. There's also some speculation that maybe Rod Blagojevich is just thinking down the road if he gets indicted and is tried in Chicago, that his appointment of a black senator would be impressive to black jurors.
And, you know, interestingly enough, the Associated Press reported that Roland Burris has declared he was legally appointed to the Senate and that he plans to take his seat. What do you make of that?
Well, he was legally appointed. I think he's right. Senate Democrats are also legally in the right under the Constitution to review his qualifications to be seated. Now, no one really doubts that on the face of it, he meets the minimal qualifications. He is over 30 years old, for example. The Senate process is such that they can put his nomination or his appointment in the Rules Committee and let the wheels of the Rules Committee grind slowly while urging Illinois Democrats to move swiftly in the state Senate with the impeachment process that's going on this week, with the hope that that Blagojevich will be impeached. Patrick Quinn, Lieutenant Governor, will take over, appoint somebody else, and then you will have Burris blocked from taking his seat.
Although that's an unseemly prospect with the Senate fast-tracking, you know, certifying Al Franken over in Minnesota and then letting Roland Burris twist in the wind. I got to figure that the announcement today reported by the Associated Press that he believes his seat is legal and that he's going to take it, it's a sort of a quiet, he's not going to give up. I mean, he may say he's not going to cause a scene, but he has every intention of playing this to the last card on the table.
I think he definitely has every intention of playing it all the way through. And when you say an unseemly process, think back to Governor Blagojevich and the court-ordered wiretaps that revealed him offering the office or offering Barack Obama's old Senate seat to the highest bidder. And you've got something very unseemly, which was kind of what launched all this. Senate Democrats said in advance they were not going to accept any nominee from Rod Blagojevich. And Blagojevich's lawyer said that he wasn't going to send a nominee. Last week, Blagojevich obviously changed his mind and did send a nominee. So that's why they're standing forth to see if Burris's appointment had anything to do with a bribe or if there were legitimate choices, maybe better choices, who shrunk back and did not take his nomination because of a process that they felt was tainted. That's the sort of thing that you could say runs against Democratic principles in offering the people their best representation. So that's the difference between Illinois and Minnesota in this instance.
But certainly, Clarence, not good news for Democrats who were certainly hoping to have more of a celebration this week with gains both in the House and in the Senate.
Right, and that's going to be the question of who gets the blame. As I mentioned, I think the winds of public opinion may be swinging in Burris's favor because he himself is such an inoffensive character and person, if not the number one choice, say, of Illinois voters. The process in the Constitution is such that you don't have to have somebody voted in this kind of instance. There's only 2 years left in Obama's old term, and so maybe he'll get seated.
So his lack of charisma is actually his greatest asset right here. So are you saying, and you're an old Chicago political hand, Clarence, that time is on Roland Burris's side here?
I would say it is. He has nothing to lose, so to speak, and has all the time he needs. John, you may remember Don Rose, the political consultant back in Chicago,
sure.
You and I have both known for years, and he once said, Roland Burris has the political soul of an accountant. And it's the kind of situation where he is certainly someone who can address the job competently, and few people are worried about him being a bad senator. So it's quite possible that he could wait this process out and be seated anyway.
Well, the investigation into Blagojevich, meanwhile, seems to have stalled. And so as Burris is sort of glad-handing people in Washington, Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney, is having maybe trouble putting together a case. Any sort of quick hit on the state of the Blagojevich investigation?
Well, one wonders. Last week, Fitzgerald asked for additional time with his investigation, which makes you wonder why a U.S. attorney would be asking for more time if their case was so good. Usually, you can go ahead and indict someone and bring in additional information later. And Fitzgerald says he does have additional.
Well, my theory there, and we won't know, but my theory there is that they want to convict him on the Senate seat, but that's what they don't have the evidence on, so they got to go back in time. Clarence Page, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, Clarence Page, joined us this morning from D.C. Clarence Page.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Today we are wishing the Mars rovers happy birthday. They are 5 years old, something the NASA scientists thought they would never see. And so we're asking you, what's lasted longer than you thought, or what didn't last anywhere near what you thought it would?
Hi, this is Lisa from Minneapolis. The longest lasting thing that I've had in my life that was surprising, we had two goldfish growing up, the Gurgle twins. And I think my mom expected them to last for 2 years, and they lasted, sadly, on her part, for 15 years. So don't ever think that goldfish die quickly.
Right.
Okay, well, there's a story. We want to hear yours, 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Well, over in Europe, winter is off to a chilly start. Forecasters expect temperatures to dip to 20 below in France later this week. And today, several European Union countries are reporting major disruptions in their gas supplies from Russia, as Moscow accuses Ukraine of shutting pipelines, which is an opportunity for them to rattle their energy savers west. We're joined now by Carol Ahoyos, chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times. Carol Ahoyos, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we understand that this sort of fight over gas energy from Russia to Europe it's not the first time we've seen this weapon used. But what are the circumstances of the turndown now, and how can this weapon be effective at a moment when prices seem to be not at a high but more of a low?
Well, in this case, this weapon can be pretty effective even during low prices. You're right. It started, the first real flare-up happened in 2006, so we've been in this situation before. But at the moment, it's I would argue, even more dangerous. Russia and Ukraine are in dire straits. Both of them are suffering substantially from the economic crisis that's engulfing the pretty much the entire globe. And, you know, one thing that doesn't change is that you need gas in the winter in Europe. And this winter is, as you said, a really chilly one. So unlike oil and the oil weapon, when you cut off gas, you start risking the lives of little old ladies sitting in the Alps somewhere in Austria or somewhere in rural Slovenia. And you can't really shift quite as easily as you can when somebody cuts off your oil. You buy it from somebody else. But if Russia cuts off their gas to Europe, it's much, much harder to substitute. So it is still a very potent weapon.
Well, Carol, let's put the weapon in context. From 2006, it seemed as though Putin and the Russian government was attempting to make a political play in Europe to say we are a sort of fossil fuel provider for Europe, do not ignore us or ignore us at your peril. It seems now, with the financial woes of Gazprom very much in the news almost daily, it's more of an extortion play. They just need the cash right now.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I would argue, in fact, the opposite. In 2006, this was a small pricing dispute between Ukraine and Russia, where Russia had said to Ukraine, look, we're not going to subsidize your gas your gas bill anymore. You no longer belong in our bloc. And then kind of Europe got incredibly frightened suddenly, threw their poker cards up on the table and went, this is going to affect us. We're so incredibly dependent on Russian gas. And in fact, when I talked to EU officials about this, they admit that they reacted really badly in 2006 and gave the game away. And it was really then that Russia kind of went, oh, wow, this is really a potent weapon. And they started wielding it much more. So this thing, everybody has a different theory, but my theory is that it started as an honest pricing dispute and then became much more political rather than the other way around.
Great
now,
theory.
Yeah, but now, it very much is both. And it is a weapon for both the Ukraine and for Russia, because Ukraine is terribly important too as a transit country. So both of them have some leverage, and that leaves Europe, which is dependent for 80% of its Russian gas transiting Ukraine, in the hands of these two parties that really are in a very bitter and long-running dispute.
Oh, even though the overland route is long, it's still probably the most most cost-effective way of getting gas to Europe. Nevertheless, during the 73 oil crisis, Europe found other ways of getting oil and sort of reshuffled its supply matrix. Is there any chance that Qatar or one of the other big gas suppliers could, through liquefied natural gas or some other source, get Europe out from under this Russian weapon?
That's a really good question, John. Yes, on the one hand, liquefied natural gas has become much more of a play. On the other hand, unfortunately, it is still a very, very small part of the market and a much less flexible one. So to get into kind of the heart of Europe is very, very much more difficult with gas than it is with oil. So really, the as I said earlier, the gas weapon is much sharper than the oil weapon. You just can't go to another producer in the same way that you can with oil.
And at least for the time being, the Russians do have this card to play. Finally, do they have any control on pricing here? Does this shutdown of the oil pipeline fluctuate the actual global price of gas? How's that been happening?
Sure. It's affected the gas price. And in fact, it's also affected the oil price because the two are linked. It's not such a huge effect because, in the summer, we were talking about $147 oil prices and very, very high gas prices. And we're now at about $50 oil. But it's definitely that and the fact that OPEC has cut their production of oil is impacting prices. But on gas, the big question is the long-term price and whether or not they can come to an agreement with that.
And, of course, it's a huge issue for, as you say, the little old ladies in the Alps who are dealing with very cold temperatures this January in Europe. Carol Hoyos, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
She's the chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times and spoke to us from London. Carol Hoyos is talking about the situation with gas, reducing the amount of gas through Ukraine to Europe, Russia using the gas weapon once again. And now Femi Okeh has headlines.
And the time is 27 minutes past the hour. The 111th Congress convenes today, and Illinois Senate appointee Roland Burris says that he'll be there. He said this morning he hopes that his appointment will be recognized today, and Burris was appointed by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. He's been accused of trying to sell the Senate seat that used to belong to President-elect Barack Obama. The congressional delegation from Minnesota has a hole as well. The race is still going on. The state canvassing board said yesterday that Democrat Al Franken defeated Coleman by 225 votes. Senate representation has a hole as well, but Republican incumbent Norm Coleman is promising a lawsuit to protest the recount result. Five Blackwater security contractors will appear in a federal court in Washington today. They're expected to plead not guilty to manslaughter. The case involves a September 2007 shooting in Baghdad, where 17 Iraqi civilians died and dozens more were wounded. Cuba is offering electronic access to thousands of documents that belong to writer Ernest Hemingway. Now, he lived on the island for more than 20 years, and the archive includes letters, photographs, and manuscripts that have languished for decades in the basement of his old home outside of Havana.
Wow.
But that's not much detective work, though, just going downstairs into the basement.
But they're apparently scanning them into the computer and allowing access. Yeah,
that's so amazing. Dismissive, Femi. But it was an interesting discovery.
Hardly a case for Miss Marple's there. They were in the basement all the time. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
Good morning. This morning, we're asking you if you've ever gotten more than you bargained for. Well, NASA did. When they built the Mars rover, they thought they would last 3 months, and lo and behold, it's 5 years later, and the rovers are still going and going. And so we're wondering today, when you look at what you've done, you've bought, where you've gone, are there some things that lasted longer or were better than you thought, or some things that perhaps lasted a lot less? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So it's an intriguing choice, or perhaps it's a controversial choice, but President-elect Obama has named Leon Panetta, former congressman, chief of staff to President Clinton. He runs an institute for encouraging young people to get into government service out in Monterey, California, but he's been chosen to run the CIA. Now, some would say it's a controversial choice because Panetta has no direct intelligence experience, even though he was in the Army. Joining us now to talk about the Panetta appointment and what it maybe reveals about Barack Obama's intentions for the security apparatus in the United States is Mark Mazzetti, reporter for the New York Times. He joins us from the Washington Bureau of the Times. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Leon Panetta, first of all, I actually spent a good deal of time yesterday trying to find on-the-record comments of his talking about national security, and there really aren't many. He's known more as a manager than as a security whiz. What does this say about, first of all, his relationship with Barack Obama and Barack Obama's relationship with the CIA?
Well, apparently his relationship with Barack Obama is very strong. And the associates of President-elect Obama were saying yesterday that this choice shows that he intends to strengthen the CIA, that having a strong person at Langley, Virginia, who is close with the president, can only help the CIA in the sort of bureaucratic battles of Washington. Traditionally, the CIA has had trouble having someone in, you know, with a seat at the table who is going to represent the CIA's views. Now, what it says about Barack Obama's view of the CIA is still unclear. Panetta, you said that you had trouble finding Panetta's views on some of these issues. That's because, you know, he does not have a long track record of speaking or writing on national security issues. He did make some comments in the past 12 months about his criticism of the Bush administration's interrogation programs, calling some of the CIA programs torture. So certainly he was saying, quote, the right things for the Obama campaign in terms of President-elect Obama's criticisms of the same programs.
But a first-rate manager, if you're an outsider, seems almost like a contradiction in terms in that there hasn't been a really great track record of outsiders being good managers in an agency that's known for its sort of chumminess, its kind of culture of interior personality, the conflict between analysts and the covert ops types.
Right. And I guess some people would argue, well, that's exactly what the CIA needs. They need someone who is from the outside, who does not have the baggage and does not have the chummy relationships, so we can come in with a fresh start. That has been tried in the past with the CIA, with different results. There have been some examples. For instance, John McCone in the 60s under John Kennedy was considered a very good CIA director, and he came in from business, and he did not have an intelligence background. However, some of the criticism you were hearing yesterday, and even from the new chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Democrat Dianne Feinstein, was that this is not the time to experiment with the CIA. You need someone, given the threats out there, who has the background, who has an understanding of the threats, and there's not really a time for on-the-job training.
And, Mark, that criticism was quick from Senator Dianne Feinstein from California.
Very, very quick and somewhat surprising to us who were covering the story. And she, first of all, pointed out that she had not been notified of the pick. And the first she learned of Panetta's selection came from the press. And as we know, that angers any member of Congress when they feel that that they weren't given the proper due in terms of vetting the pick. So so she was certainly angry about that. But more importantly and more substantively, she said that she feels like we need to have someone with a deep intelligence background. And this is the trouble that Obama faces right now, specifically with this pick, and this is why it caused so much problems for him. You have to, you know, he on one hand needs to find someone who is capable and experienced and can kind of pick up right where the Bush administration left off in some sense in terms of going after al-Qaeda. On the other hand, he needs to find someone who's not, in his mind, tainted by a lot of what's happened in the Bush years.
So it's hard to find people who are experienced in the intelligence community who don't have their hands in the torture or the lack of WMD or the sort of George Tenet quagmire. Is that what you're saying?
That, I think, is in Obama's view, that was a lot of the dilemma. Now, certainly the person who was kind of his principal intelligence advisor in the campaign, a man named John Brennan, who many thought would get the CIA job, had to withdraw his
name.
from consideration because there was a lot of criticism about his real or imagined role in the detention interrogation program. It was still murky. His problem was he'd made some very some comments since he left the CIA that seemed to support a lot of these programs.
Well, Mark, really quickly, back to the Feinstein thing for a second. You know, is it possible that there's some baggage here in the California delegation between Feinstein and Panetta that we don't know anything about? And, of course, Panetta is known as Mr. Compromise, Mr. Intergovernmental, bring everybody to the table. Is this thing likely to pass?
The first question, I don't know what the history is there. I mean, there certainly is. They were, I thought, known to be somewhat close, and so it's hard to know whether there is real baggage. On the second question, but that's something we'll be looking into. On the second question, I would say the likelihood is still that the president-elect will get his choice to the CIA. Dianne Feinstein did not say, I will vote against him. She
right.
did indicated that she was not in favor of the nomination. So that's something that can be negotiated over time.
Thanks, Mark. Mark Mazzetti, a reporter for the New York Times, talking about the Leon Panetta nomination for director of the CIA. Mark Mazzetti joined us from Washington. Femi Oke is here with the headlines.
Hello there. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Just looking at the markets, the Dow is up about 60 points so far. President-elect Barack Obama wants to give the economy all the help it can get.
Right now, the most important task for us is to stabilize the patient. The economy is badly damaged. It is very sick.
President-elect Obama has called for passage of his massive stimulus bill to be approved within 2 weeks of him taking office. It includes billions of dollars in tax refunds for businesses. Israel says that it stepped up its assault in Gaza and has killed 130 militants in the last 2 days. Palestinians say the offensive intensified this morning, and today's meeting between a high-level European Union delegation and Israeli President Shimon Peres has failed to put an end to the violence. Toyota will suspend production of all 12 of its plants in Japan for 11 days in February and March. Toyota says that the last time it halted production at all of its Japanese plants was back in 1993, and that was just for 1 day. President Bush is making the largest ever marine conservation effort in history. He's designated nearly 200,000 square miles in the Pacific Ocean as National Marine Monuments, and that means that the areas will be exempt from drilling for oil or other natural resources. And let's look at some stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adore Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. 130 militants killed in the last 2 days in Israel's offensive in Gaza. Palestinians say the offensive has intensified this morning. But covering events in Gaza is not easily done. We spoke earlier with Ethan Bronner, Jerusalem bureau chief for The New York Times. Ethan, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, John.
Now, we've heard a lot of the details of what's coming out of Gaza today, but really the question is, how do we decipher what's happening? Because the media access seems to be very, very difficult. You were having trouble getting into Gaza yesterday. What is the sort of scale, and is there a pattern to media access or denials of access on the part of Israeli authorities?
It's a slightly complicated story that I'll try to simplify as best I can. Until 2 months ago, there was never any question about media access to Gaza. But suddenly, in early November, as as rocket fire on Israel increased from Hamas, the defense ministry started to close down the crossings to journalists. And basically, we couldn't get in for the entire past 2 months. There were 1 or 2 days when suddenly they'd say you could go in. But once the war began, it was totally shut down. We, as a foreign press association, objected first quietly to various ministries and army and so on, and prime minister. And ultimately, we went to the Supreme Court, which ordered a week ago a government to allow a pool of reporters in. It said you can't keep the foreign press out of Gaza. And so we arranged a pool of 8 reporters, and I was in that pool. And 3 days out of the last 4, we were told to come down to the border for the possibility of getting in, and each time they said it's too unsafe to let you in. Yesterday in particular, Right after that, they let in the head of the United Nations Relief and Work Agency. So why it's safe for him and not for us, not clear.
Well, Ethan, what do you say to the people who, you know, are very, very concerned about Israel's security in this situation and may even write letters to the editor, to your newspaper, that, you know, it's up to Israel to decide, that reporters don't necessarily take Israel's security into consideration in a situation like this, and you're just going to have to wait?
Well, I mean, all we're asking is that the Israelis stamp our passports and let us through the international border between them and Gaza. And actually, it's not we who are asking. It is the Supreme Court of the country that is demanding it of the government. So I understand that there are security issues, both for us and for the operation and for the troops. And I understand there might be certain rules. One of them was that you don't let hundreds of people in. There are hundreds of people along the border waiting to go in. I'm talking about journalists from around the world.
Sure.
They were going to let in 8 of us, and they still have not done so.
Well, we spoke with your colleague Tigrid Al-Khodri yesterday, mm-hmm. also a BBC reporter who was in Shifa Hospital inside Gaza. And, you know, this isolation means that the accounts of what's going on in Gaza are almost diametrically opposed to the kind of accounts you see outside. I wonder if it's not necessarily in the Israelis' interest to restrict press access as they have.
Well, I mean, they clearly think there's a long story here about how what happened in the 2006 war in Lebanon and what happened in the disengagement, as it's called, from Gaza in 2005 in terms of media access. There was quite a lot in both of those cases. And particularly in the Lebanon war, it was determined that this wasn't necessarily such a good thing for Israel's strategic goals.
Well, once again, echoes of 2006. Ethan Bronner, New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief, reporting amidst media restrictions by Israeli authorities, restrictions being challenged in court.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 6th, and Femi Okeh is here with the headlines.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. President-elect Barack Obama's appointed successor in the Senate, Roland Burris, says that he's going to Capitol Hill to take his seat today. Burris says that he'll attempt to be sworn in. This morning on CBS's Early Show, Burris explained why he's so determined.
The people of Illinois need to have two senators on the ground preparing to carry out the wishes and desires to try to impact their quality of life. And we cannot let our 13 million people of Illinois be shorthanded in this regard.
Burris has told Senate security of his plans. Senate Democratic leaders say that he won't be given the oath of office. The Minnesota Senate election results may be certified, but we still don't know who the winner is. The official count puts Democrat Al Franken ahead of Republican Norm Coleman by 225 votes. Candidates get a week to challenge the results, and Coleman's lawyers say that he plans to. President-elect Obama has settled on his top spy masters. He chose Leon Panetta to lead the CIA. The former Clinton insider is a surprise pick since he has no direct intelligence experience. And retired Admiral Dennis Blair is being tapped for director of national intelligence. Let's look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. 3 months. That's what they gave Spirit and Opportunity, those little Mars rovers, and they went on for 5 years, and the entire planet Earth fell in love with them. Has that ever happened to someone you love?
I work at the Atria, and someone who's lasted longer than I ever could have imagined is one of my residents, Rosie, who was born in Hungary, and today is her birthday. She's 102 years old. My mother outlived everyone's thoughts and ideas or doctor's predictions, and lived to the wonderful age of 101 and a half. She just passed away this holiday. She's a wonderful person and made many people very happy.
Or what about something you bought?
1986 5-liter Mustang. I just renewed its tags for 09, and Ford could make a lot on small transactions simply by continuing to sell me parts for this great automobile.
Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Something that's lasted one heck of a long time in the Senate are the desks. Today, the 111th Congress officially opens, and on top of the agenda is the economy. And Democrats start this year with 20 new seats in the House, and the picked-up seats also in the Senate. Not clear how many, since there are a few seats still in flux. First, though, there's a matter of who gets which desk. Each one of them has a story. Here's Mississippi Senator Thad Cochran describing his desk, once occupied by Jefferson Davis.
He actually resigned from the Senate and stood at that desk to announce to the Senate that he was having to resign his seat in the Senate because his state had just seceded from the Union.
Joining us for more of the behind-the-scenes history is Todd Zwillick, reporter for Capital News Connection. As always, welcome, Todd. And how in the world did you get interested in the senators' desks?
You have to be a little bit of a history geek, I'm afraid, but this is part of the living history of the Senate. One of the ways you get into it is that the Senate curators, the ones who keep track of all the art and sort of the physical history of the Senate, put up a fabulous, fantastic website on Senate.gov that lets you click around a map of the Senate floor, all 100 mahogany desks where the senators sit. And each of them has a lineage and a pedigree, in many cases going back to, all the way back to 1819 when the first 48 desks were put in place. And there's a lot of history there, too. And you can click around. And if you're a political junkie, a historical junkie, this is a great way to look back into the history of the Senate and all of the personalities who've come through there over the years. It's really pretty fantastic.
So all of the desks, all 100 desks on the Senate chamber floor, the ones that, you know, you see on television, each one of them has their own story that dates back to 1819?
Well, most of them do. Well, not even most. Half of them do. Here's how it went. In the War of 1812, at the end of it, in 1814, now we lost that war, and the British marched into Washington, and they burned the Capitol. And the way they burned it was they went into the Senate chamber, the old Senate chamber, they piled the desks in a big pile, and they lit them. And that's part of how they lit the Capitol on fire. So all of the desks at that time, including a desk that belonged to Aaron Burr, they all went up in flames. So in 1819, the Senate commissioned 48 new mahogany desks. There were 48 senators at the time. So those 48 still exist on the Senate floor. They've lasted all the way since 1819.
Wow.
And the others have been added two by two as states have joined the Union since then. So about half of them go back that far.
And so what does it say about the senators? Are they haggling for these desks? And are certain senators after certain desks with certain histories?
Oh, yeah. You'd be surprised, actually. Now, the assignment of desks, like everything else in the Senate, works according to seniority. So the longer you've been there, the more choice you have in most cases. There's exceptions to almost every rule here. But the longer you've been there, the more choices you have. Senators like to choose desks based on a hero of theirs, maybe a great senator or someone who's become president, someone from their state who they respect, or maybe a relative. I'll give you an example. It actually violates the seniority rule. What Ted Kennedy has been in the Senate for about 34 years. He came to the Senate in 1964. That was the year after his brother, who was president, was assassinated, of course. Well, when he got to the Senate, he was a junior. He had no seniority whatsoever, but he was given his brother's desk. His brother had been a senator, of course, for one term before he was president. He was given JFK's desk by more senior senators. They thought it was appropriate that he have his brother's desk, and he's never left it. He still has it. He's never given it up, and one would assume that he probably never will until he leaves the Senate one way or the other.
So what's going to happen to President-elect Barack Obama's desk?
Oh, now this is a very interesting story. All throughout, well, the election and even before, the Senate curators and the historians were really hoping that Obama would sign his desk. Now, part of the way they keep track of who's had which desk is this tradition of carving your name or signing your name inside the flip top of the desk. These desks sort of look like the ones you might have had when you were in school in the third grade. The top flips up and you can keep stuff in there. And
Senators, third graders.
Well, they do. They keep everything from pencils and bills to hobby magazines and Popular Mechanics. They keep all kinds of stuff in there. And they can keep anything they want. They're supposed to lock, but I'm not sure if they really do.
Are there bad luck desks there, like Harrison Williams' desk, who was almost expelled or was expelled from the Senate, and maybe senators who had like a bad story that nobody wants the desk?
You mean like Joe McCarthy?
Yeah,
or something
there you go.
Like
the
that?
McCarthy desk. Ugh.
Right. Well, I don't know, John, because, you know, somebody has to have it. There are 100 right. senators and 100 desks. So if there is a bad luck desk that nobody really wants, they certainly don't share it. But there are good luck desks. Let me get back to the Obama story real quick. They were hoping he would sign it, and he hadn't signed it. Now, there's a tradition that senators do sign their desks, but you can't make them. Nobody can make them do anything. And in fact, some of them don't. Obama became more and more popular, started running for president. Then it became clear that he was going to be president. And then the desk takes on new importance because he's going to be more than just a one-term senator, obviously. The story is, and I talked to the curators about this, it actually took one of the stewards, one of the doorkeepers, to pester Obama all summer long to sign his desk, and Obama kind of kept him at arm's length. And then apparently this fall, this doorkeeper approached Obama with a Sharpie and foisted it on him during one of these times when Obama came back to the floor, and Obama went and signed his desk. And the beautiful thing about it is this. People might want, you know, a rare desk. It belonged to a president, Lyndon Johnson, Jefferson Davis, something like that. Somebody like Harry Truman, who was in the Senate for 10 years before being president, he moved around a lot. He signed 10 desks. So if you want a Truman desk, there are 10 choices. It's not that hard to come
by. They're cheap.
They're cheap. There's only one Obama desk. He wasn't in the Senate that long, and he only signed one desk. We'll see if he's great or not. Who knows? But if you really want the Obama desk, there's only ever going to be one.
It'd be interesting to hear that discussion as somebody haggles for that one. Todd Zwillick, thanks for that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Blagojevich will just sell it, you know.
He'll just... I don't think they're going to let him near that Obama desk. Right. Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection coming to us from Washington and telling us about the history of the U.S. Senate and desks.
One Obama desk, two Mars rovers, and it's their fifth birthday today. I hope you got them a present. One of them needs a new tire. It's way longer than NASA thought they would last. Did that ever happen to you?
I think Paris Hilton's career has gone on for way too long.
My son being Mixmaster. I got it as a wedding present. It lasted over 30 years. They don't make them like that anymore.
I wanted to mention my Norwegian sweater that I bought in 1967, and it somehow won't die, and not only won't die, it even continues to look good.
Oh yeah, it looks really great on you. That's great. Yeah, don't ever get rid of that. Rajashri sent us an email. When I moved to the U.S. as a newlywed with my husband in 96, I bought the cheapest toaster available for $7. 12 years later, my family has grown 3 kids. I like to upgrade to a 4-slot toaster, but the trusty old one turns out perfect toasts every time. I don't want to discard it. Keep the conversation going on our website, thetakeaway.org. And this is the question that keeps on going because here's another one.
Yeah, one of the things that really lasted longer than I thought is my take. I really didn't think it was going to be a hit, and it is, especially due to the two of you people who are intelligent, bright, sharp, and way beyond my expectations.
We just have to work on the name. Thank you very much. Got to get the branding of the name. My take or the takeaway. Call it whatever you want, but we're always on. You can subscribe to our podcast at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm
Adore you, Doja.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.